He is thrifty with his needs. He's not wasteful, right? He only goes and seeks after the things that he needs and are vital to him. He is good-natured and mild-tempered. His soul is firmer than steel, whilst his ego remains lower than a slave. Meaning, he's mild-tempered, meaning he doesn't get angry a lot. Right? He's good-natured. His soul is firmer than steel, meaning he has, he has a firm resolution. Nothing can shake his resolution. And his ego is lower than a slave. He doesn't have any ego. He's not proud. Rather, he's very humble. Thank you for joining us here on Hadith of the Day. We were looking at the virtues and characteristics and features of the believer in the words of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha for the program Hadith of the Day on RIB English Radio.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
Doing us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, just over 1 week remains to June, the first deadline for the U.S. government to raise the debt ceiling, which is currently at $31.38 trillion. If the debt ceiling is not increased, the government will not be able to continue paying its bills. The debt ceiling debate has become synonymous with wrangling between Democrats and Republicans and seeing which concessions can be received. Republicans want to use the crisis to get the Democrats to cut back on spending. Democrats say it's not the right time for that, as the country is facing a crisis. In the middle of all this, it's the people who are on edge and wondering what is really going on. Well, I'd like to welcome my guests to this program. Help me look at all of this. Out of Atlanta, Paul Craig Roberts, Chairman of the Institute for Political Economy and former Assistant Secretary of U.S. Treasury. And out of Washington, Marcia Baker, economic expert, EIR, I believe. Thank you both for being with me. Good to see you. Paul, what is going on? Let's talk about this debt ceiling. Let's simplify it. I mean, for those of us with not strong economic background, what is going on here?
Typically, the two parties jockey over what spending can be cut. The Republicans have their favorite slate of spending cuts, and the Democrats have their own. And normally it goes right down to the wire, and some agreement is made. It's never failed in the past, even though the media pays a huge amount of attention to it. It is possible that something else could be going on this time. I've noticed over recent years a tendency on the part of some Western governments for the executive to bypass the legislature. We saw that recently in France, where the French president simply removed the issue of raising the pension age from the legislature and raised it by edict. Mm-hmm. We've seen similar edicts on the part of George W. Bush and Obama, suspending civil liberties. And this is sort of a growing trend that's gradually accumulating power in the executive. Now, if an agreement is not reached, and if Biden refuses any sort of accommodation with the Republicans, it would be on purpose that an agreement is not reached. But Biden can simply then declare a national emergency and raise the limit by himself. There's really nothing to stop him from doing that. And it could well be that this is part of some program of further eroding powers of legislatures in the Western countries and further putting them into the hands of the executive.
Interesting. Well, Marcia, what does it mean when the U.S. government debt of $31.38 trillion is about 22% more than the value of all goods and services that will be produced in the U.S. economy this year?
Well, first, let me just endorse what the speaker just said about the, so to speak, politics, if we're moving to edicts, government by edicts. Mm. But in your question, what does it mean? It would be very bad to have a shock of interruption to functioning of debt offerings, public debt. But let me not go into scenarios, but instead say that this kind of impasse we're seeing of discussions of whether to agree on a debt ceiling level represents a generalized incompetence in the leadership layer, because our dollar system and our domestic economy, and we can talk internationally as well, is really in breakdown. You know that the degree of lending is shrinking in the general commercial economy, for housing, for businesses, for small businesses. You've seen four banks, regional banks, fail. Mm-hmm. There has been a removal of deposits in our banking system in the United States of $1 trillion within the last year. And this kind of withdrawal of funds is going on, $12 billion first quarter this year. So there are interruptions and breakdown. And whether Republican or Democrat, this is not being faced, with a few exceptions. Speaking of Congress, where the action is, and there's some talk with President Biden, as you know, there are moves to look more seriously at the economy. Do you know there's a reintroduction of the what's called the Glass-Steagall Law from the 1930s that operated for 60 years that would help re-regulate banks so you could have credit to restore production? But so far, it's rear guard.
Yeah, well, it's interesting they're talking about restoring that after so much theft has taken place and so many businesses, unfortunately, have gone down. Well, Paul, I mean, U.S. President Joe Biden says America is not a deadbeat nation. We pay our bills. How true is this reality? I mean, because the U.S. gets away with a lot because, of course, the dollar so far is still the global currency, although definitely diminishing fast. I mean, tell me what that has meant for the United States to be able to do what it does.
Being the world currency means that everyone else pays your bills. Mm-hmm. You see, if you are the world currency and your currency is used to settle international transactions by the rest of the world, there's a huge demand for your dollars, for your currency, in this case, the U.S. dollar. And this demand for dollars absorbs all of the debt that results from the United States trade deficit and the United States budget deficit, because the foreign central banks are willing to hold their surplus dollars in the form of U.S. Treasury bonds. So being the world reserve currency, it means you don't have to pay your bills, or that you pay them by printing money, because the rest of the world uses your currency to settle its international transactions, and therefore the world's central banks hold the dollars in the form of U.S. Treasury debt. And so financing the American debt has never been a problem since the dollar became the world reserve currency after World War II. And this is often overlooked by the debates in the Congress about debt and so on. When the debt becomes a problem is, as you noted, when the dollar loses its reserve currency role, which recent American policies are causing to happen, such as the Russian sanctions, the Iranian sanctions, the seizure of the Russian central bank reserves. These are convincing other countries that it's risky to hold on to dollars because you can be sanctioned that way. And so we see increasingly countries settling their international transactions in currencies other than the dollar. And this is what is the threat, not so much the American debt, but the fact that it's losing the ability to have the rest of the world finance its debt, mm-hmm. because it's driving people away from the use of the dollar as world reserve currency.
Well, what about that, Marcia? I mean, in so many ways, it seems like the United States is just shooting itself in the foot. On the other hand, they're making a big deal about the debt ceiling crisis that, as Paul said, at the end of the day, they're going to increase the, they will increase it as they always have. On the other hand, it doesn't seem like there's a whole lot of attention to the fact of that the dollar is falling fast and the effect that that will have overall on the United States and American lifestyles.
You're quite right. Things are moving steadily along. There are central banks in the world getting out of the dollar and buying quite a bit of gold. It's not as if it's dramatic or overnight, but this process where we see China, India, and Russia discussing a potential new system for exchange of currencies for trade to replace the SWIFT system of the West, all of these things are moving along. And there is a blankout as well as a blackout in some of the current office holders of the United States on this, but it's definitely happening. Plus, I could add the war economy effect, that syndrome where, for example, in all the wrangling over the debt ceiling in Congress and with the White House, there has been agreement not to touch the $870 billion U.S. Fiscal year 2023 military budget. So if you put war expenditures in the transatlantic, in Europe as well as here in the U.S., on top of the decreasing activity in the real economy, industry, agriculture, infrastructure, this is a very grim picture. It could be reversed, but it's headed towards worse and real crisis.
Well, Marcia talked about the war economy. I want to talk about that a little bit, Paul, because on the one hand, the government says it may run out of money, but on the other hand, there is always money for war and the war machine. And even in the middle of this so-called crisis, we see the billions are steadily going to the war effort in Ukraine. I mean, what does it all mean, Paul?
Well, the President Dwight Eisenhower warned the country in 1961 in his last public address as a two-term president about the military security complex. He said that we had not disarmed after World War II because of the Cold War, and we had watched the military industrial complex, is what he called it at the time. We still had industry in those days, was gaining so much power that it might become a threat to democracy. And of course, they have enormous campaign contribution funds. If you go against their budget, you will be cut off from funding. Your opponent will get the funding. It's a very dangerous and risky thing for any member of the House or Senate to cut the military budget. And even the Democrats who claim they want to do it, they won't really do it. It's their response to the Russians, to the Republicans, who always want to cut the social spending. So I think that on the whole, the situation is sort of understandable. And the only real ingredient I already mentioned, it may well be that this is a opportunity that the executive branch will use for Biden to give an order that the debt ceiling is raised. That would be the most unique feature about the current controversy.
Okay, well, Marcia, I mean, there are those critics who say this whole crisis situation dealing with the debt ceiling is manufactured in the way the attention is brought to it, and basically trying to reflect or deflect to from something else, other things that are happening in the society, or perhaps, as we've already talked about, the fall of the dollar or the fall in general of the power of the hegemon. I mean, what's your perspective on that side of things?
Well, I agree with you. You put your finger on it the way there are manufactured issues in the U.S. media. My fellow panelist was talking about the military-industrial complex, and really you have a military-industrial academic media complex, and keep going. They are saying, that, whereas for many Americans, they are seeing in their localities and their states very drastic social and economic breakdown examples. 63 rural hospitals are on the brink of shutting down right now around, especially the farm states. You have the suicide rate among youth, and by the way, among farmers, I just mentioned farmers. You have more homelessness, suburban housing crisis. You have the end of the public health special program for COVID-19 that was announced a week ago by the federal government. So no more special kind of help for food aid, housing aid, hospital aid. And this is all going on when your television is telling you you must follow like a sports event what's going to happen with the debt ceiling. So there's a disconnect there. It's going to get more and more. And I think some of the demonstrations, as your program just mentioned, the Belgian workers are in the streets. You've had farmers demonstrate in Europe. And here in the US, the growing dissatisfaction with the rubber stamp, very dangerous, continued military support for Ukraine is not just an economic issue, it's becoming repugnant. And so that's the real background that's taking place behind the apparent issue of the debt ceiling debate.
Well, Paul, I mean, in the middle of this that we've talked about as far as reactions from the Republicans or the Democrats, and basically they're going to go after their interests and make sure they stay in office. In the middle of this, the American people who are suffering, really suffering, now, as Marcia's just pointed out, various issues as far as pointing towards deterioration of overall lifestyle, what is it going to take? She also mentioned about demonstrations in Belgium and other countries. But in general, the American populace may hear and may say they understand what is going on. But at the end of the day, it seems that little is done as far as pushback against these government policies.
Well, you see, when I was a young man, the United States had a homogeneous population. But there was change in 1965 to immigration laws, and we have now become a multicultural situation in which identity politics is used to separate the various components of the population and turn them against one another. So we have all the black antagonisms against whites that are increasingly expressed in stronger and stronger words. We have the sexually perverse people who are making new claims and demands for recognition and criticisms of the more normal heterosexual people, so that there's really no social unity. So there's no united people. What the United States is today is a Tower of Babel. The greatest problem that we face remains unrecognized. Again, when I was a young man, the United States was self-sufficient economically. It was short only in energy. Well, a self-sufficient economy doesn't have to worry about trade deficits. But what offshoring of American production has done from globalism, the offshoring of U.S. manufacturing to China and Asia, has made the United States import dependent, because when the offshore production of American firms are brought back to the United States to be marketed, they enter as imports. And so by offshoring our production, we guarantee that we would have forever a very large trade deficit. And so we've already touched on this situation. When the dollar ceases to be the reserve currency, there's no way to finance this trade deficit. And so what happens at that point, the U.S. dollar simply collapses in value. Well, the worst inflations in history are caused by currency collapse. So if the dollar collapses in value, being import dependent, as the United States is, there'll be a massive rise in prices and a huge decline in real incomes. Well, if we already are afflicted with homelessness and poverty and so on, which we are, those situations will become worse. So the attention of the United States government should be on how to bring the jobs that are offshored back so that we don't create a needless, unnecessary trade deficit that sooner or later is not going to be able to be financed. So that is the real overriding problem, because if we see a collapse in the value of the dollar when we are import dependent, it means a tremendous hit to American living standards, which have been taking small hits all along the way now for some 20 years. So that's the real challenge to Washington, and you can't get anyone to acknowledge it or to mention it, because globalism has become sort of like an ideology. People are committed to it. They think it's absolutely necessary, and so on and so on, and they've been given all sorts of false promises about it, but it's actually extremely deadly.
Right. Well, let me get Marcia in. So sorry, Paul. Let me just get Marcia in this last minute or so. Marcia, you heard what Paul just said. I mean, what we have seen in the United States when he was talking about, for example, in the 60s, and of course, a very large middle class. And now we've seen that shift, that financial shift to that 1%, that 1% or that 10% at the top, getting richer and richer as the bottom 99%, the bottom 90%. Actually are under more pressure. But at the same time, if politicians, those who are running the country, are not willing to actually do what they need to do to improve for the average American, to improve the situation, I mean, your prognosis of where you see the United States heading to?
It's a tall order, but it's possible to make a shift. And we have no choice. Those of us, and there's people everywhere in every country that can do what's individually necessary, can make the difference, because the flip side of de-dollarization is we need a new world financial and economic framework in which we re-rev up production in a place like the United States, we still can re-regulate banks and issue credit for projects, water management out west, all that kind of thing, and respect other nations and work with them. Now, we have to counter the blackout in the United States of where this kind of development is going on. Look at China and the Central Asian five presidents next door to Iran just met and worked out projects. We have projects needed in North America. It may be a tall order, but this is what we have to do, because okay. The opposite of that is chaos and global NATO war. We don't have a choice.
All right, and on that note, unfortunately, we're out of time. I appreciate both of you being with me. Paul Craig Roberts, Chairman, Institute for Political Economy, and former Assistant Secretary of U.S. Treasury out of Atlanta. And out of Washington, D.C., Marcia Baker, economic expert. Thank you both for being with us, and thank you for staying with us on Another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi, signing out for myself right here in Tehran.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, adornment. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about adornment in the Islamic lifestyle. What we can see in the Islamic teachings is that adornment is being made by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Allah loves adornment, and that's why He put this in every single human being, that they love to adorn themselves, they love to groom themselves, they love the situation. Why? Because they want to look good. They want to be someone who looks good. And even, you know, when we see a mirror, we just go in front of that. And this is in our nature that we start adorning ourselves. We start, making ourselves right. If our hairs are blurry or maybe it needs combing, we start combing our hairs. And in anyway, we see that we love to make ourselves right. We love to be prepared. We love to adorn ourselves. And whenever we are invited to some place, we don't just want to wake up and walk outside and go to the place where we were invited. Rather, we prepare, we put on new clothes or the good clothes, and then we adorn ourselves, and then we go. So it is something that is been given by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. It's in the human nature. Why? Because when Allah has adorned this universe with different things, the beauty of nature, the beauty of galaxies, the beauty of stars, the beauty of this world, when we see, we are amazed of that beauty. Similarly, for the human beings, they need to beautify themselves, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of adornment in the Islamic lifestyle. We said that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, He has made this universe beautiful, and He has adorned this universe with the stars, with the planets on this earth. When we see there are different types of birds, animals, the beautiful birds with their beautiful voices, and there is the beauty of nature that we see in the deserts, in the mountain area, in the green area. So everywhere what we see is something that is beautiful. And it looks like someone has painted this world, and it's beautified this. So there was a special adornment, there was a special, a preparation of adorning this world in different ways. And it is in the nature. Why? Because God, who has created all of us, he loves this adornment. And being the human being, if we want to have an Islamic lifestyle, it is necessary to basically adorn ourselves. And that's why we see even in chapter A'raf, which is chapter number 7, verse 32, Allah says, قُلْ مَنْ حَرَّمَ زِينَةَ اللَّهِ, say that whoever forbids on him the beauties of Allah, the adornment and the beauties of Allah, الَّتِي خَرَجَ لِعِبَادِهِ وَالطَّيِّبَاتِ مِنَ الرِّزْقِ, that this one, why is he making things forbidden for himself, which Allah has beautified for his servants from the tayyibat, from the purified things, from the rizq, from the sustenance that Allah has provided to him. Why there are some people who are forbidding these things for themselves?
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
With reporters.
The right to go on strike, to withdraw one's labor over grievances with one's employer, potentially under threat in proposed legislation that gives the British government sweeping powers to clamp down on industrial action.
They say it's democratic when it's not democratic, so they're an affront to democracy, what they want on this bill. And it'll turn worker, they want to turn worker against worker, but it won't. It'll just cause confusion.
Mr. Speaker.
Formerly known as the Minimum Service Level Bill, voted on in Parliament Monday, the legislation enables the government to determine what a minimum level of service should be, with potential consequences for strikers and the unions that represent them.
Without the unions would face sequestration of their funds, which is obviously a serious, very serious step, and unions can't afford to go down that road. So it will effectively stop strike action in those parts of the economy, but it will also seek to scare people in other parts of the economy about what will happen to them should they take the decision to go on strike.
The freedom to form and join a union and to bargain collectively is one of the four international labour standards which the UK government has signed up to.
The UK is part of the ILO and signed up to all of its conventions. So the right to strike is really a fundamental human right. It's something that we should protect and be very aware of any legislation that seeks to restrict that. And I think, you know, I think internationally people will be concerned that here in the UK we're seeking to restrict that right.
Among the sectors impacted by the legislation, health, education, transport and fire services, all of which have staged several rounds of industrial action over pay and working conditions over the past year in the face of the UK's cost of living crisis.
Strikes became common during the Industrial Revolution. The UK has recognized the right to strike since at least 1906. And the protesters and union leaders here say they're not going to allow that right to be eroded or taken away. Saeed Poreza, London.
Specialists at the Republican Hospital in Donetsk have warned that the number of civilians who have been hospitalized is dramatically on the rise as Ukrainian armed forces are using more advanced NATO-supplied weapons. Almost 1,000 wounded have been treated since the beginning of 2023, the trauma center in Donetsk has reported. Specialists believe that the latest weapons sent by NATO countries are more advanced and lethal.
Until not long ago, only civilians living near the front line got wounded or killed. Now, following the new medium and long-range weapons provided by NATO to Ukraine, we have a much higher number of civilians being hospitalized. Look behind my back. Our hospital was targeted a few weeks ago.
Ukrainian armed formations have shelled hospitals a number of times over the past months. This hospital in central Donetsk, Voroshilovsky district, was hit by the artillery on April 28. That shelling caused 9 civilian casualties and severe damage to the building. On that occasion, among the dead civilians was also a child. 16 people also suffered injuries from the blast. Kyiv's forces fired high-explosive fragmentation missiles produced in Slovakia and transferred to Ukraine by NATO countries.
We have been denouncing the situation since 2015. We started with the European Court of Human Rights, but for inexplicable reasons, our case was dismissed. We tried then with the International Criminal Court, but they have never visited the Donbas, and this case was subsequently dismissed. We are now trying to bring it forward to the UN. Will human rights be finally protected here as well?
In fear of attacks on residential areas, kids have been forced to switch to remote learning throughout the whole school year, which, by the way, ends on Tuesday. Max Civili, Donetsk.
To commemorate the 23rd anniversary of the liberation of South Lebanon from Israeli occupation, Hezbollah conducted an unprecedented live military drill in the South Lebanese town of Aramta. After a show of hand-to-hand combat and a parade of all-terrain vehicles and motorcycles, the fighters launched a simulation of taking over an Israeli post in the occupied Galilee area. Over 100 media outlets covered the event, which many say is something unseen since before the liberation in 2000.
The location chosen for this is quite telling. First of all, it's close to the border with Israel. And, of course, this area back in before 2000 was under Israeli occupation. The old Bir Kalab outpost the Israelis had was just up on the hill behind us. So this is very familiar territory for Hezbollah.
The head of Hezbollah's executive council, Sayed Hashem Safieddine, warned Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that his cabinet will not be able to change the rules of engagement.
Our message to Israel is clear. If you think that you can launch a full-scale aggression in order to strike the equations of deterrence, which we made with our blood and armaments and strength, we will be ready to shower you with precise rockets, and you will witness black days unlike any other. The Israeli regime knows what we mean. We will use our precise rockets and all means available to us.
Observers see that Hezbollah is primarily seeking psychological warfare against Israel with this maneuver.
But clearly the message is towards the Israelis primarily. As we've seen with the recent escalation in Gaza, we've seen a tightening of the ties, the military ties between Hezbollah, Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and so on. So I think this show today feeds into that.
Hezbollah says the drill sent a message to the Israeli regime about the readiness of the resistance to deter enemy aggression and defend Lebanon. Israeli forces left most of southern Lebanon on May 25, 2000, after 22 years of occupation.
Hezbollah's military drill is not merely a show of force, with prospects of a possible confrontation and continuous Israeli aggressions towards Al-Quds. Hezbollah wants to send a clear message to the Israelis that its deterrence capabilities remain intact. Mariam Saleh, South Lebanon.
UNICEF representative for Afghanistan says some 90% of the population in the country is on the brink of poverty, while children are the ones who are bearing the brunt of it. The UNICEF states some 2.3 million children in Afghanistan are expected to face malnutrition in the country, while roughly 1.6 million Afghan children, some as young as 6, are trapped in child labor, working in dangerous conditions just to help their parents put food on the table.
The children pick these waste materials and sell it to me. Instead of going to school, they work to earn a bread worth. These kids are doing this job out of necessity because some of them have sick parents and take care of them, or their parents have no job and tell the children to do this for a living. They can hardly buy bread with this earning.
Mohammad Qasem, a 12-year-old worker, says he can't go to a school because he should provide bread for the family.
I am 12 years old. I pick these bottles under the scorching sun to sell and buy bread for the family with this money. I don't go to school because I work every day to earn some money. It has been 3 years that I have been doing this.
Experts believe decades of war and unrest in the country is to blame for the poverty, which is compelling families to send their loved ones on the streets to find a mouthful. But of course, the negative consequences aren't negligible.
Most of the problems in the society originate from poverty. It is due to this poverty that our children are working on the streets. But we should keep in mind that the child who is working on the street is a lost valuable asset without a bright future for the country.
U.S.-led war in Afghanistan has ruined the country's economy. It has also made Afghanistan weapons contaminated too. 134 children were killed or maimed while collecting scrap metal to sell from explosive devices between January and March of this year alone. While Afghanistan is struggling to resolve problems left behind from decades of war, many people here believe U.S. sanctions and the reduction of activities of international organizations have made the situation more complicated in the country. Abdullah Amirzadeh, Kabul.
The Islamic Jihad resistance movement has organized a celebration event in Damascus countryside, marking its victory against Israel in the recent battle in the Gaza Strip. In a televised speech, Secretary General of the movement, Ziad Nakhale, announced the victory against the Israeli regime, expressing pride in the people of Gaza, who he said manufactured their own weapons with the help of member countries of the resistance front.
We succeeded in the battle and we preserved Palestinians' unity. We proved to the enemy our continuous readiness to engage in battle after another in defense of our people. Any assassination operation will be met with a strong, clear and painful response in which Tel Aviv or other Israeli cities will be in the range of our rockets.
The event was attended by representatives of Syria-based Palestinian factions. Speakers said Palestinians and resistance groups showed unprecedented unity through the joint operations room while retaliating against Israel. They rejected any concessions with Israel and refused to acknowledge any political settlement with the enemy.
We underline the importance of national unity and armed resistance, which is the only option we have. We reject concessions, Oslo Accords, or any security coordination or recognition of Israel. We call for boycotting Israel politically and economically and punishing the enemy for the crimes against Palestinians.
Videos were played on a large screen showing the retaliatory battle codenamed Revenge of the Free, including images of the Islamic Jihad leaders who were assassinated or lost their lives while confronting Israeli attacks. Resistance movements like the Islamic Jihad believe that resistance is not an option, but in fact a national duty which is based on the legitimate right of Palestinians to fight against the Israeli regime. And for long, it has been the only successful deterrent against Israeli aggressions in occupied Palestine. Hamad Ali, Damascus Countryside.
Just a couple of weeks ago, there were hundreds of refugees, mainly from African and Middle Eastern countries, sleeping on the streets outside the main asylum application centre in Brussels. Authorities have since cleared the area. The refugees have fled to neighbouring countries or have been crammed into emergency accommodation. A few remain in the area, but say their situation would be different if they came from Ukraine.
Only because we are Afghan, because we come from Syria, because we don't have the same color, because we don't have same culture, but it will be not the reason. Of course, a lot of people, we have the same mind. I can work, I can do everything.
When you come here from Ukraine, you get everything. Accommodation, food, work, everything. If you are from somewhere else, as a refugee, you do not get anything.
If you look, I cut also myself, because we don't feel good in camp.
Sometimes you want to die?
Yes, I want to die. You look at my hands, I cut it my hands too much with blades. I do it too much. Because what is it, life, eat and going to sleep?
A debate in the European Parliament has heard that EU nations are erecting borders on land and strengthening aggressive coast guard services at sea. The bloc pays billions of euro to outside countries to stop refugees from attempting to travel here, unless they are from Ukraine.
The EU slogan is, break the business model of smugglers. But what we do is feeding them. By blocking all pathways to protection.
There is a heavy far-right anti-refugee presence in the Parliament.
Europe needs a policy based on strong border control.
But many legislators are calling for a more civilized approach.
We already fund third countries like Libya, actually militias over there, to build camps, to host people there. And we see murder, we see rape, and we do not see a humane solution.
Key EU figures are currently in Hiroshima, Japan, for a G7 meeting. 350,000 people were living there when their closest ally, the United States, dropped its catastrophic atomic bomb in 1945. More support for Ukraine is high on the agenda. Critics say the last thing on their minds is providing refuge to those fleeing countries they helped destabilize in Africa, Asia, and the Middle East. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
For the first time since massive regular protests began in January, the French government has held discussions with union leaders regarding a 2-year hike to the retirement age. A notable problem with that long delay is that the age hike has already been forced into law via a decree by President Emmanuel Macron. Public opinion is overwhelmingly against the change, but the government is standing firm, even though anger is rising to threatening levels nationwide. The First Lady's nephew was recently beaten by protesters over the age hike. Over 60% of the country wants the Prime Minister fired, and neither Macron nor his ministers can appear in public without protesters noisily banging casserole pans.
There's enormous anger right now. Macron has destroyed our social services, given huge tax gifts to the rich, persecuted injustices while allowing the far right to demonstrate without barely any police presence. And this is not even a complete list. People just want to live normally. But the Macron era is one of sadness and poverty.
Unions say the country will not get back to normal unless the age hike is revoked. But France has seen massive anti-government unrest regularly for well over a decade, and usually over far-right austerity measures. France and the European Union continue to be hounded by accusations that they are anti-democratic, and the latest of many French presidential decrees has only further increased dissatisfaction and dissent.
There is growing realization that our major national policies are decided in Brussels, and that our president is a mere puppet. We're also subservient to Washington. Simply look at what we're doing in Ukraine for more proof. So there's no hope that we'll have democracy during the last 4 years of Macron's term. But if we don't get it in 2027, things will explode.
Union leaders left the closed-door meeting, calling it not useful and a one-way monologue.
The pension age hike has overshadowed other crises, such as record inflation, the arming of the unrest in Ukraine, and stagnant wages. But all of those remain unresolved flashpoints as well. Barring a surprise reversal from the government, unions are planning a 14th day of nationwide strikes next month. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Hundreds of Orthodox Jews protested outside the UK Parliament building on Tuesday over fears the establishment will begin regulating traditional Jewish faith schools known as yeshivot. Protest leaders made clear they considered any legislation targeting unregulated Jewish religious institutions as anti-Semitic, and they may be forced to flee Britain to protect their religious freedoms from unwelcome reforms.
Today, we face a concerning challenge as politicians attempt to push through a proposed register for children educated outside of school. This is no ordinary bill, but one that seeks to sneak in new laws through the back door under the guise of a private member's bill. This register proposal targets our strictly Orthodox Jewish community, intending to undermine our way of life more than any other group. It reeks of state-sponsored anti-Semitism.
What concerns these religious Jewish parents is regulated British education mandates lessons on lifestyles which contradict Jewish religious beliefs, including relationship and sex education, or RSE, LGBT propaganda, and other anti-religious ideologies, including atheism.
Well, we're not talking about murdering anybody. We're just talking about what we don't want our children to be taught. And we're just following what it says in our religion. And it's absolutely disgraceful that you're not allowed to do that in this country. And that's anti-Semitic.
These protests come after years of public anger expressed by parents, particularly British Muslims, over RSE lessons already being implemented in state schools. Opt-out options are not available, and accusations of indoctrination or anti-religious propaganda being fed to young children has been rife. In January 2023, a petition went viral, gaining over 200,000 signatures, demanding the government remove LGBT teaching from the controversial curriculum. The government responded, saying,
"The statutory guidance states that all pupils should receive teaching on LGBT content during their school years. Secondary schools should include LGBT content in their teaching. Primary schools are strongly encouraged and enabled when teaching about different types of family to include families with same-sex parents."
The ruling Conservative government has routinely attacked left-wing opposition over their support for the Palestinian cause and their criticism of Britain's relationship with the Israeli regime. However, and quite ironically, it's now number 10 that finds itself on the receiving end of not only accusations of anti-Semitism, but also Islamophobia and for being anti-religion in general, over an education system which is perceived to be discriminating against religious minority rights. Robert Carter, London.
Liberation of Khorramshahr. Day of resistance, self-sacrifice, and victory. 24th of May was the day when the port city of Khorramshahr in southwestern Iran was liberated from Ba'athist occupation in 1982. This day has been named as a day of resistance, self-sacrifice and victory in the Islamic Republic of Iran. The history of the Holy Defense is full of great days which have remained in the minds and hearts of people with honor. But the day of liberation of the strategic port city of Khorramshahr is one of the greatest of such days, if not the greatest of them. The beautiful port city is located in Khuzestan province in southwestern Iran. It was the scene of very hard resistance of the local people and selfless sacrifices of the forces who stood against the invading Iraqi Ba'athist army for 35 days with their bare hands until the port city fell on 26th of October 1980. However, Khorramshahr was freed from the clutches of the Ba'athist regime after 578 days. The port city of Khorramshahr was liberated through the cooperation of the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps, the IRGC, and the Iranian army. The liberation of the port city was the main goal of the fourth phase of the Bayt al-Muqaddas operation. This operation put an end to 19 months of Ba'athist occupation of this most sensitive part of Khuzestan province. Yet the liberation of Khorramshahr was a very decisive blow to the Iraqi regime's war machine and the prestige of the Ba'athist regime. The liberation of the port city of Khorramshahr was so important that the founder of the Islamic Revolution, the late Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, called it a divine grace and an extraordinary achievement. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has also called it a unique event in the world's history. The liberation of the port city of Khorramshahr is known as a turning point in the Iraq-Iran war. The Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein had boasted that if ever Iran took back the city, he would deliver the key to Basra to the Iranians. The liberation of the port city of Khorramshahr cost the Iraqi army very dearly, as over 16,000 of its forces were killed or injured, and more than 19,000 others were taken as captives. After the liberation of the port city of Khorramshahr, the valiant Iranian forces held congregational prayers at the Jame Mosque in the city of Khorramshahr, and the news of the liberation was broadcast everywhere in Iran, and the people rejoiced and they were exhilarated at hearing this great news. The founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, the late Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, issued a message on the occasion of the liberation of the port city of Khorramshahr. The Imam said, "Thanks to the telegrams which were sent to me on the liberation of Khorramshahr, unbounded gratitude to Almighty God who granted his favor and support unto the Islamic country, and the devoted and selfless combatants and bestowed this great victory on us." The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has also commented on this occasion. The leader said, "When our armed forces started their move in the Bayt al-Muqaddas operation, with prudence, clear insight, faith-based willpower, trusting God, using all facilities at their disposal and relying on their own force, and God the Exalted, no one in the world believed that they could liberate the port city of Khorramshahr. But that's actually what they did. When we announced that we had retaken the port city of Khorramshahr, the world's news agencies were hesitant and they did not want to broadcast this news for a couple of days. They were looking at it with doubt. But this event occurred and finally everyone was forced to admit this great victory for the Islamic Republic of Iran.